Yo, what up? I'm Danny.
And I'm Reno.
And I'm Keith.
And I'm Jimmy Garecki, and it's all bad.
As you might have noticed, there's no more ads on this show. And that's possible because of Patreon and guys like you and gals. So please subscribe on Patreon. We got special gift for you, and tell a friend. Dude, thanks so much for coming out, Jimmy.
No, yeah, thank you. Yeah,
we've been trying to lock this down, man, for a little bit. Yeah.
Sick. Yeah. Sure, I'm psyched, man, to be here. Sure.
Yeah. It's good to see you here in the after hours.
Yeah,
you
know, for sure, yeah. I'm a morning guy.
You're a morning guy. Yeah, oh, yeah.
I can't do evening sobriety, man.
Dude, I told somebody outside that Garecki was coming. Danes. She goes, he's back. He wasn't at the morning meeting.
Yeah.
I swear.
Yeah.
People be keeping tabs on you.
Yeah. Sure. Evening sobriety, I can't. Yeah. I can't do. I think the only evening meeting I ever went to was my second meeting ever with you,
Reno. We went to Yosemite together.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
wow.
It?
That's it, yeah.
Wow.
And I got home and was like, this is too overwhelming for the nighttime for me. You know, like, yeah. I got to start my day this way, not end it. Yeah.
That's cool.
That's actually smart.
It is.
You ever try that shit, Keith?
No. But I should.
It's just tough when you have a family, like, to get out at night all the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's... I mean, especially as the kids get older, like...
Fool, you know D ain't listening. Quit trying to butter it up.
The other day, she sent me a meme on Instagram of, like, some guy. He's, like, saying this, like, narration. He's like, I love to be touched by my partner. Blah, 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 blah. And the dude the whole time in the video is cleaning a house. Like, just mopping floors and cleaning showers and all this shit, and talking about how, like, you need to meet your partner where they are and, like, take stress off their plate and, like, you know,
bullshit.
I swear to God. So she was basically telling me if I want to get any, I need to become a fucking maid. I told her, don't be trying to indoctrinate me with that shit.
This was reinforcing. Before I got here, I was like five carne asada tacos in. I'm watching the Phillies play, and I hear the dishes being cleaned, and then my lady looks down at me laying on the living room floor, and she goes, did you notice how I did the laundry? I cooked, I cleaned, and she listed off all the things that she did today.
Damn.
And I was like, I'm fucked right now.
And you're going to bounce.
I got to go record a podcast.
You really ain't shit. Yeah.
I talk shit, but like literally, I picked the kids up, brought them home, and she's like, where you been? I got to get the girls to Girl Scouts. I'm like, don't worry. Leave the bags where they are.
Yeah.
I'll have dinner on the table before I leave. And I definitely did all that.
Really?
Did the dishes, made the kids food, put it on the table, had everything cleaned up or whatever. Then my daughter sent me a text. Thanks for dinner, Dad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And your lady's probably rolling her eyes.
Like, no doubt.
One dinner.
No doubt, exactly.
Hey, but his daughter also sent him a text the other day. She's 7. No, she's 9. Dad, where the fuck are you? We see your car.
Dude, straight up. They, like, have figured out cuss words, and they, like, have fun with it around us only.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things where it was, like, I was meeting them at the restaurant at the Oinkster, and I was, like, in the car, thought they weren't there yet, and I'm, like, getting caught up on texts and bullshit, and all of a sudden I get a text, Dad, where the fuck are you? We see your car. So crazy, man. All huge blessings of this program, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'd be waiting in that car for the Connect or someone else's car because I wouldn't have a car.
Yeah.
Because I'd be busted as fuck. Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's right.
He'll be here in a minute, man. Just chill.
I'd be at the bus stop waiting, you know? Yeah.
For real.
When did you start drinking and using, Jimmy?
Man, you know, I was a late bloomer. I was always afraid of everything, man. My old man... my dad was never in my life. My mom was, he split on my mom maybe month one or two of me even existing. So it was always pretty well known, you know, he was an alcoholic, he was a druggie. He's still partying to this day, man, you know. So I had like the classic like father heartbreak growing up. So that scared me away. You know, I had older sisters that were kind of wild. I had uncles that tried to make up for my dad, and they suffer from the same gene, you know? So I had all the things in my peripheral to keep me away long enough. And then, you know, and obviously growing up and skating, it's around you,
yeah.
You know, it's like everyone I skated with, I was always the young buck too, in every single crew. So I held out for as long as I could, and I have the lamest first drinking story. It was my freshman year at Temple University. I lived in the dorm on Broad Street. All the frat houses were across the street from the dorm, and it was like Monday night was Sig Ep, Tuesday night was, you know, whatever, Phi Lambda Lambda or whatever. And I remember we went to the shitty one, and all they had was Natty Ice.
Ah.
And I had 5 or 6 Natty Ices, and I was like, oh, this is my first feeling of, like, wow, what being drunk is, you know? And,
yeah.
And I just remember feeling, like, hella wobbly, you know? And, like, I cracked the can on it, yeah. Wow.
So, all right, so you grew up in Philly.
Yep, right outside of Philadelphia. Outside,
cool,
yeah,
where at?
Yeah. A town called Narstown. It's about 15 minutes outside the city, 20 minutes. You know, we grew up in a pretty rough neighborhood, man, for like till I was about 10, 11 years old, single mom. I had a step pops that she ended up meeting. He lived with us, but I very much wasn't his kid. You know, it was like we grew up. It was a 3-story row home. She paid $270 a month for. The first floor was a funeral home. The second and third floor were ours, but there was an open hallway that connected the units. So it was like, you know, you live in a fucking mortuary, basically. Like,
oh, wow.
Pretty. And she, you know, you're selling candy and stuff for school or selling cookies. And she said, go down and see Miss Vaughn. And I'm like, Mom, I can smell formaldehyde.
Damn.
Before I even get to her door, you know, like.
Yeah.
Wow.
So then, you know, and then we kind of, her and my step pops, when I was, yeah, they ended up buying a crib in a nicer neighborhood when I was about 12 or 13, but still in the same section outside of Philadelphia. But once I discovered, like, Center City, Philadelphia, I was gone every day. That was it. Just jump on the train. It was like a seven, you know, I could lie and say I was 11 or 12 years old. It was like 75 cents per ride. And that was it, you know. So played sports and shit and skated. But like really was like kind of falling in love with skating at that point in my life, you know. So
how old were you? How old was that? 11, 12?
Yeah, man, I was a baby, man. I remember my grandparents lived in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, which is way in the sticks. Pretty classic story. I'm sitting on my grandfather's porch, and I see these older guys in all of the shit. They all look hella cool, dragging launch ramps to the high school across the street. And that was like the moment I was like, whatever those guys are doing, that's what the fuck I want to do.
Be down. Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a Vietnamese family that lived across the street that all the brothers skated. And that's who I'd hang out with when I'd go there. And they kind of just put together this fucking Frankenstein board for me with all different pieces, a Goldwing truck, a Tracker truck. Like, it was bad, you know, but it was like, all right, I could go skate with these guys.
Yeah. I hated both those truck brands.
But even again, in my grandfather's house, he was an old Italian guy, you know, and there was always wine out, you know what I'm saying? My sisters grew up in that climate and drinking wine when they were younger, you know, so that, all those things were always right in front of me. I remember there was a skate park I used to go to called Cheapskates. And
that's like, a great name.
Oh, it was amazing, yeah.
Cheapskates?
Cheapskates, yeah. And it was a pretty famous skate park. Like, people would come from all over the eastern border.
Was there a
border.
Shop connected to it, Cheapskates?
There was a shop there, yeah, for sure. But the crew that was, like, the guys there, the locals, and I was a kid, and I just remember being blown away. I'd pull up, and they'd be, like, 3 or 4 40s deep, you know? Yeah. It was always kind of right there, you know, but enough to scare me off until it couldn't anymore, you know? So
what was the theme music at that time? Hip hop music?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was Mobb Deep. It was,
yeah.
And I was always trying to put the pieces together with like what skate culture was.
Gangstar.
Back then you had some magazines, you had some videos, whatever you could get, but you couldn't really get it readily enough. So like, you know, but classic, like, shit, like, I'm pretty bipolar. I think I'm into, like, the Rollins band, but, like, I'm into Mobb Deep, and I'm just trying to embrace whatever I think skateboarding is in 92, not, you know, 91, 92.
Wow. It's such a trip how, like, those videos and magazines, like, they just, like, get burned into your brain.
Oh, yeah.
It has.
Yeah.
Big Brother, yeah. Thrasher, the videos, the people's parts, the music that was playing during those parts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how you found music. You would hear a song on somebody's part and you'd be like, oh, like you still to this day associated with
1,000%. Yeah. 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 I mean, a lot of groups, man, the Artifacts, like
when Hieroglyphics.
I think of whoever was the A&R at Loud Records and told 411 that they could use the whole first Mobb Deep album. Like that was genius because that like planted the seed for Mobb Deep and specifically that album to skate. Like there's a lot of 411 parts that are amazing that ran through the soundtrack to that album. And it's like, maybe I might not have been privy to that if it wasn't for those videos, you know?
Was their first album wasn't Shook Ones, right?
Shook Ones was on there, right? Give Up the Good.
Survival of the Fittest. Yeah.
That whole album, man. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you started skating. You're cutting out, you know, you're cutting out, going to the city, going out there to skate, going out there to hang out, just to get away.
Just disappearing, man. Yeah. My mom was really cool, man. She was, for being like a single parent, mm-hmm. working 17-hour days.
Damn.
She was like adamant on having things that were, you know, distractions. She obviously knew the voids in my life. You know, two older sisters are gone doing their thing. They don't want to watch their baby brother. My mom put me in every sport until I was not big enough to participate in everything. I was, you know, high school, like 100 pounds soaking wet my freshman year.
Yeah.
So she got me into wrestling when I was in about 7th grade, and my area had an amazing wrestling program, a good feeder program, and the high school program was nationally ranked. So I got thrown into this, and all of these kids are like in fucking incredible. So I got like wiped, like mopped up for 2 or 3 years, and the coach was like telling my mom, like, keep him in it, you know, like he's going to figure this out, and the program that he's in is going to, you know, he's going to be able to kind of rise with it. And and luckily I did, man. You know, it was like it kicked my ass, you know, but there's a lot of parts, a lot of like my discipline and work ethic comes from wrestling still. Like I still, you know, it's funny, I see all these guys doing jiu-jitsu now, I'm like, you guys are late to the party. I'm like rolling around, you know, on the mat. Like, but you know, like it kicked my ass, but it was, you know, it was like the thing that I needed, because skateboarding gave you like this certain mental freedom, but like I needed something else that my mom couldn't provide, that, you know, I didn't have any other thing, and kind of the family as well. I was always that kid that like, you know, who's taking Jimmy to the tournaments or who's taking Jimmy to the game? So I had families that were looking out for me. And, you know,
it's actually a perfect combination, really. Like, because I grew up skateboarding as well and hanging out in the streets and all that kind of stuff. But like the kids that I knew that were doing organized sports, like most of them went on to do well.
You know what I mean?
And like took the SATs, went to college. You know what I mean? Like really like.
Yeah.
You said the discipline and the participation and the connectivity and like encouraging each other to do good and do better, you know, like, yeah, your friends are encouraging you in the streets and shit, but like maybe to do the wrong shit. You know what I mean?
And I was torn because I wanted to skate. I recognized that, you know, it was something that I loved. And also like the Philadelphia scene was like on fire skateboarding wise.
Yeah.
You know, but I was connected to this program and these kids that I kind of was helping them, I was part of it, you know? So, and thank God, you know, I remember I quit my senior year because that was when skating was like really starting to take off for me. And I remember my coach was also the school disciplinarian and he was like, bro, you're letting your community down, you know?
Oh, wow.
My mom was heartbroken. You know, these kids that I had wrestled 3-4 years and, you know, we traveled the country because the program was good. We'd go to a really big tournament in Reno, another one, you know, all the Temecula schools out here, you know.
Damn, you were coming out from Philly to wrestle in Temecula?
Temecula, because Temecula had a really good program back then.
Wow.
And I remember the day before I could qualify for eligibility, or be the cutoff. If I didn't, if I would have signed up a day later, I would have been off that senior year. I was like, nah, you know what? I'll do it, you know? And I had shit with skating had just taken off. I had landed a specific trick that landed in a video that got me on. And it was like, all right, Jimmy could be off on the running on a skateboard. And I just disappeared for 6 months, 7 months from skating to wrestle. And it, you know, when I look back on everything, it was like, you know, not to get in the big book all early, but it's like, you know, the things how it talks about we, you know, we find these other places to go and disappear and, you know, just whether it's geographic or, you know, I was already doing that back then. You know, it was like it was kind of like the early start of it for me, you know, and but then once wrestling was done, then it was just skating. Now it's like I remember just showing back up at Love Park and these guys being like, where the fuck did you go? You know, like you just did this trick. It's in all the videos.
What was the trick?
There was a handrail right across the street from Love Park. And at that point, no one had ever really skated it. They just grinded it. And there was security there all the time. And I did a backside lip slide on it, which at the time was like a higher echelon trick. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened, which I think I sent you, that Dill was there, Abe mm-hmm. was there, Freddie, like all of the DC guys were there. All of the Alien Workshop guys were there. You know, like there, like, so it was just kind of the scene, you know, had I done the trick on a different day and not had everybody there for them to pan over, but it was kind of like a culmination of what Love Park skating represented, where it was like a really, you know, it was like a community driven thing. Like all the footage was awesome because you seen guys filming tricks and you seen all the people hanging out there. It was a vibe, you know?
Yeah.
So that specific trick caught the vibe, and it was just like, it kind of just like epitomized skateboarding. I'm the luckiest skateboarder in the world. I got on with one trick, you know, like, you know, like all these guys got to like put together serious video parts. Like I had one day that just changed everything for
That's
me,
dope.
You know,
so. That's so dope.
But it was like, even going back to wrestling, it was like, it was one day, but I know even back then it was something I was working towards because I recognized how big the scene was there. I think I had a wherewithal that maybe guys a lot more talented than me didn't have. I was like, yo, there's all the magazines. They just want Love Park. All the videos, they just want Love Park. All the companies in LA, they just want Philly skaters. You know, so I'm like, I realized that like this was my opportunity. So I would blow all the videographers up. I'd tell them I was going to do tricks. I had no fucking shot to be able to do just to like book time with them. I'd be like 7 a.m. on a Saturday, and I'd sit up all night Friday night sleepless, like couldn't wait, you know, like you know, because I was like, that's how much that's I did amazing. Love it, you know. Yeah. I still love that's it amazing. But that's what I was like, if I got to trick these guys into stealing time with them and finesse my way into these like really upper echelon skate circles. And if that's what I got to do to get on, I'm going to fucking do it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, so, by any means, right? Yeah.
And how old were you then?
It was like 17, 18, 17, wow. Yeah. I remember it was the day that I did that trick, it was Halloween Day, 1999. And I knew I had wrestling practice starting that Monday. So it was a Saturday. I remember landing the trick, smoking a cig, just being like, I'm not going to see these fucking guys for months. And they're like, and they're going to be wondering where the fuck Jimmy's at right now, you know? And then I showed up 6 months, 7 months later, like hella fat from coming off of a crazy wrestling weight loss. You know, they're probably like, what the fuck's wrong with this guy? You know, like, I wrestled.
Because when you wrestle, you learn how to like add, cut.
Dude, I started that season like 150, and I wrestled in the postseason 125. The next day after I was eliminated, I was up to 160.
No way.
So like that's such an unhealthy.
In one day.
Within about 24 to 48 hours. You know, like.
Holy
that's
shit.
The gnarly thing about wrestling, and I hope. Kids, I feel like I've learned that they're way tougher on the weight loss now, because back then it was insane, man. You know, like it was nothing for a kid to drop 20, 30 pounds.
Yeah. Would you know? Be like in the sweat room and all that?
Oh,
shit?
Dude, I would be. Yeah, you know, I would. It was like not eating all week. It would be practicing cardio. Then when it's done, getting in a sauna suit, running, sitting in a steam room, getting piss pills to like piss off all your, you know, all your water weight.
Yeah.
Like
it was, what do they it call was a those? Gauntlet.
I don't know. My mom would give them diuretics. To me. I love you, mom. My mom, that's how committed my mom was. Wow. Like, yo, you're fucking making weight, you know, like,
damn.
You know, so.
Jay, yeah. We had Jason Ellis on, and he was telling us about that too.
Oh,
about
get out of here! Jason was a gnarly wrestler.
Yeah. He was he's a
MMA guy,
right?
Yeah,
or boxing. It was MMA and boxing, right?
Yeah, I think he does a little bit.
He's gnarly
MMA.
All around.
Yeah, yeah, he's just yeah. But he was telling us about that, about how when guys cut, you know, and it's crazy.
But that's what's funny. 20, 30 years later, when I'm realizing that I'm probably 15, 20 pounds overweight. From way too many Modelos, and I'm still pulling out
was
the
that
sauna
your brand,
suit.
Modelo?
Yeah, whatever. You know, as long as it's beer, you know, it's like, but I'm still pulling out the sauna suit. I'm still thinking I can kick my ass all night and go run some hills the next day. And I'm just gonna, you know, and as you get older, you're like, bro, this is not coming off as quick as it used to.
When did it start going dark?
That's a good question, man. You know,
when did you start drinking alcoholically? Because like,
yeah,
you're at a point now where you're talking about you yeah. left wrestling, you came back to love. When you got back to love, did they open arms like, yo, you're back? Let's
yeah,
do
hell
this.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah,
that's when it that, was on it.
Man,
popping.
You know, when I think back as I was a kid, like I remember going like my 19th birthday, it didn't end well. My 20th birthday didn't end well. My 21st birthday, I didn't even make it for my attendees. You know, so when I think back on...
Fuck, I was in rehab my 21st birthday.
Yeah.
For real, court ordered.
When I do the mental gymnastics of thinking what my relationship with booze looked like, it was never good.
Yeah, I'm over here trying to clown.
So, you know, probably as far back as I can remember, I was never successful at it. You
right.
know, like, I can never... The guy that I could see just grab a drink... You know, and just relax with it. Like, that was never me.
Right,
you know?
But then again, like, you're in your 20s.
Yeah.
You're a pro skater. You're traveling. You're, you know, in different cities doing your thing and stuff. So, obviously, you're not, like, kicking back and having a fucking Grey Goose and soda. It's like when you're done with the shit, everyone got a bunch of beer and you wild it out.
You got to think, too, like, early 2000s, partying. You know, this is where skateboarders are beginning to get access to places that they've never been allowed into. You know, when I look back on like some of the brands and the people that were at the height of skateboarding, like the Piss Drunks and, you know, like those guys would come to Philadelphia and I would see how they would operate. They would do a gnarly trick and then it was like celebration time, you know, and those guys were all really close friends with my friends. So it was like you had that influence. And then just coming up with kids, I was still in college. So it's like I had all my college friends who were doing the college party thing. I had other kids my age, other skaters who were just exploring life at 21. So, you know, every corner I looked, it's right there.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Did you get into college with wrestling or?
I didn't know. I pondered doing it, but the schools that wanted me to wrestle for them were in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And really, I just wanted to go to one school, which was Temple University. And it was a train ride from Love Park.
Yeah.
And that ended up being the only school I applied to. And I was like, that's it. You know what I'm saying? Like the dorm is here, Love's Park here. I can either skate all the way down Broad Street. I can jump on the subway.
Yeah.
Are they both on Broad Street?
They're both on... Yeah, basically, Love is one block off of Broad.
Yeah.
But Temple's right there at the heart of North
Philly. Is Broad like the main street in Philly?
Broad Street is the main street. It runs all the way from the Delaware River all the way to as far north in Philadelphia as you can go.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
And, you know, I mean, that's the other thing, too, man. Philly is a drinking-ass city.
Yeah.
Philly's a everything city.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, weed, you know, it's like, thankfully I was scared enough of the harder shit to never even go near exploring it. You know, like there were other things I'd be like, man, I probably would enjoy that. You know, like I know enough to not go near that. I've got, you know, that's the thing is like, I've got friends. I unfortunately lost friends early on, kids I grew up with, kids I skated with, that unfortunately, you know, like got it in into harder stuff. So, yeah. You know, there were things there to scare me enough away.
Yeah.
You know, I do thank skating because it kind of kept me, you know, I had good older homies that like I could tell had invested a lot of hope into me. So like that was enough to make sure I stayed driven in that regard. Just made sure I finished school. I just was like, these opportunities would be too dumb to blow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you finished college?
I did finish school. Yeah. It took me 5 or 6 years.
Damn.
I would take a semester off, you know, and that was going. So I skated for Sal Barbia's Respect. Company, Aesthetics. Sal's, and again, Sal's like a legend in skating.
Yeah.
Sal took us to Zoo York. And then when Zoo York was done, one of my closest friends, Nino Scalia, was working with Pharrell. And got me involved with when Pharrell was starting Ice Cream and BBC. And now it went from like skating on really really core respected companies to like now you're skating for a company that's in a whole different hemisphere.
Echelon, yeah.
Which it was good and bad because it was like the skate community hated it. And I had close friends that were like my like real close skate buddies being like, this is insane that you would take this opportunity. Then I had other friends that were like, bro, this type of opportunity doesn't come around. Like, you would be stupid to not do it. And
no, totally. You know. I mean, you hear pro skaters that we've had on here or pro skaters that we know. It's like you get, like, the same little lame deal. You get a couple $100 a month from a shoe brand. You get, you know, a couple more bucks from a clothing brand. And, you know, if you're lucky, you get, like, you know, free decks and shit. And then, like, the promise of one day you're going to get a deck. And
I think at Aesthetics, I was when I got paid, I thought I was rich. I was getting $250 a month. $250 a month. And then we go to Zoo York, and they're like, you're getting a raise. I got $500 a month at Zoo York.
Wow.
And that's for boards and clothes. And then when we got on Ice Cream, I think it was $1,500 or $2,000 a month.
That's unheard of.
So now I'm like, all right, this is legit. And I kept jobs during that time period. So I always worked in like sneaker shops. I worked at Ubic.
Yeah.
I worked at the skate shop. So I tried to stay.
Brian wasn't Ubic, right?
Brian's Laps on a Hammer. Yeah. But Ubic was ill because it was this Korean guy, John Lee. He partnered with a guy named Homeo that started Atmos.
Oh shit, Homeo was part of Ubic?
So Homeo would come to Philly from Japan and we would have to hide inventory because even though they were business partners, he was like, dude, Homeo will take all of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I was Ubik's like...
Homeo's this legendary Japanese dude.
Dude, that huge pink mohawk, you know, like, and this store...
Ubik, I didn't know that he looked like that. I've only seen like images of him like recently.
Oh, you was so bugged out. You'd be like, "What? Who is this guy?" You just knew.
Wait, he'll come and take all the shit from the
shop?
He
would come to Ubik and they'd be like, "Bro, go in the stock room and put it all in like the cleaning room or something." You know, because he would take it all.
He was an investor.
He was an investor, so it was like to him, it was like, "I have right to take this product and take it back to Atmos in Japan and sell it there."
Used to run around all up and down the I-95 buying dead stock Nike from like old stores and taking it to Japan and just caking, selling the stuff. And he started Atmos, which is basically like, you could say like early Kith of Japan.
Yeah, 1,000%.
Like
multiple
locations.
Yeah.
Really?
And this
still
store.
Still around?
Yeah, hell yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Ubik was one of the first. I would go on record and say one of the first like Nike Tier Zero accounts. So all this shit would be showing up on the shelves. There was this beautiful store in the middle of the gallery in Center City, which back in the day the gallery was like the mall, but it was like, you know, every neighborhood in Philly would converge on this mall. Some of the gnarliest shit I've ever seen took place in mall. I remember one guy was shopping and he was in a wheelchair and the undercovers come in. They lift him up out of the wheelchair and I peek underneath him and there's a burner, there's baggies, put him in handcuffs, take him away. I don't know if he was handicapped or not. I seen another guy get robbed at gunpoint right in front of me while he was shopping on the shoe wall.
Wow.
What?
Then the gnarliest thing was, for whatever reason, Chingy performed in the middle of this mall. And I've never seen more kids in my life in one public setting. They rushed the stage and apparently had been able to swipe his watches and rings.
No
and it's just
way.
15, 16-year-old kids just walking through the mall smoking. It was, this mall was so many. You know, like it was gnarly. But
is it still there?
It's still there. They've remodeled it. Now it's like the fashion district. But all of these, you know, Sneaker Villa, DTLR.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's the height of like rap fashion brands. So every, you know, there was 20 different stores that had all of those brands back then. And they're
so,
you know,
all those chains had stores
in there.
So DTLR, Villa.
All of them.
Ubic was in there.
So Ubic opens up in there.
So obviously Foot Locker was in there too.
Bro, we would... this was ill. We got our hourly rate, but then we also got 1% commission untaxed. And nice. I remember one Black Friday, I did like 12 grand myself. So, and there's 20 other kids working that are selling just as much.
So,
for a 19, 20-year-old kid, this was like amazing money.
Yeah.
You know, like, because these items... I would just stand by the Timberland wall because I knew the dudes would come in all day just needing construction boots. If I knew a Jordan 8 was coming out, I'm not leaving that Jordan 8 wall until that inventory is gone because I'm getting commission.
Yeah.
You know, and kids are fighting like, yo, what's that? You know, I'd be sitting there waiting for somebody to tell me their size. And my coworker would be in the back of the store and he'd be like, yo, what size you need? And I'd be like, nah, you're not taking.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because like.
Commission that, sales is most aggressive. Yeah,
That that mall was gnarly. I remember coming in for Black Friday one time. And, you know, obviously the Thanksgiving night, the night before Thanksgiving was obviously a big drinking night. And I remember going into work one day and all these kids are waiting for the gate to go up. And I remember walking through and I remember one girl just goes like, man, somebody smells like alcohol. And it was my dumb ass.
No way.
I decided to hang out at the skate bar the whole night before.
Damn.
You know, knowing damn well I had to be there at like 9 a.m. on Black Friday.
So at that point, you were getting it in.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a trip, man. That's when I got into the rooms to think back on what that career looked like was like, man, I had a very low batting average for years. Like, my win percentage was so low, man.
You think you're doing great. You're like, when you're in it, yeah. It's man. Like, you know, it's like, you know, it says like our alcoholic life seemed the only normal.
Yeah.
It's like, and when you're in it, you're like, oh, this true. Is dope. Yeah, you know, like.
Danny looked little, fucking you know? Crazy yeah. when he was loaded.
Oh, yeah, I mean, my shit, like, you know.
Wearing lace and some fucking weird hat. Wigs.
Yeah, I used to wear wigs. I used to just like think, I was like, oh, I'm going to wear wigs, you know. So the cops won't fucking catch me slipping, you know. Living out of like a motel. And I was like, this is great. You know, I saw a picture
of you with like a dread wig, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like a Jamaican dread wig on.
Yeah. And it travels too. So it's like if I came out here, you know, this my friends that I stayed with to skate out here, they did the same thing. If I went to New York to skate, my friends that skated in New York, they did the same thing. So it's like, you know, it's kind of unavoidable in certain circles. You
almost
know?
Every skateboarder I know has alcoholism.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
No. So almost ever.
That's
sober,
what I, when they say that AA should not be allied with any sect denomination. It's like, bro, if there's one denomination it should be allied with, it should be skateboarding. You know, it might save a lot of fucking lives.
Skateboarding, graffiti.
Yeah.
What I call one man sports.
Yeah.
Because people don't talk enough about that. Think about like you know what I mean? Like you're playing baseball, you're playing football. Skating something, graffiti something you can do by yourself.
Yeah.
You don't need anybody.
Nah.
Yeah.
There's something to that.
Yeah.
Jake Rosenberg. When I first got in the program, I remember reaching out to Jake. And Jake is, you know, Jake filmed all of like the Plan B videos and stuff. And, you know, I knew there were older guys from skating that I could reach out to and talk to. And Jake was one. And, you know, Jake said, look, Jimmy, when you think about, you know, you've been skating your whole life. You've been battling the skateboard. It's the same battle you've probably been fighting with booze your whole life. It's just you versus that thing. You keep going back knowing you could get fucked up on the next try. You're in it until you land it.
Never satisfied.
And you think, yeah, so that you think with drinking, I can...
There are parallels to that.
You know, you can...
Yeah, that's
crazy. And I think even with wrestling, it's like, that's just kind of how my mind had always been wired to fight these one-on-one battles, you know, like, no matter how far behind the eight ball you are, you know, it's like...
Abe will call me in the morning sometimes, like 6:30 in the morning, he goes, fuck, man. I'm like, what? And he goes... I've been going to battle with this fucking lady. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, you have that 1,000%,
like,
yeah.
Just getting hurt and like, but you know, like by himself, you know.
Yeah.
I had plenty of proof, man. There was more than enough. You know, Abe, obviously, someone whose story is very well known. I think we're very fortunate now that he's sharing more and more. But I had more than enough documentation to show me where certain roads could lead to. You know, I have a weird thing. Like after I had my kid in 2011, 2012, and my daughter,
were you still living in Philly at that point?
No, we were here. We were here. Yeah.
Okay.
And my wife's career was taking off.
Where'd you guys meet? You and your wife?
We met downtown LA.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I was friends with her.
So you came out here on your own before you guys met?
You guys are going to laugh about this. So I had... towards the end of Ice Cream, we had a TV deal with MTV. We were going to do a reality TV show. Thank God it didn't happen. That would have been the death of all of us. Because the whole, you know, you prop this skateboard crew up next to Pharrell Williams. It's like a recipe for disaster. There's a lot of money. Every day it's like, get on a flight to Miami, get on a flight to Japan. But we have this show. Dick House is going to produce it. And thankfully, it doesn't happen. Ice Cream ends. And within the 3 or 4 month period that I know that Ice Cream is going to come to an end, Jeff Tremaine, who is the founder of Dick House, he's done Jackass, shows. Jeff called me, goes, my buddy's working on this TV show, Jimmy. Just go meet with him. And I always thought, like, why did Jeff believe in me to go have that conversation with this guy? He's got... You know, Jeff started Big Brother Magazine.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, totally.
He's got a whole world of skate people he could have called to take this meeting for him. And I go to have coffee, and it's fucking Fred Savage from the Wonder Years.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, oh, wow. What the fuck?
Fred's cool. I know Fred.
Yo, hella cool.
Way cool.
So we're flipping through skate mags, and I remember this is January of 08. And he's like, all right, well, I'm shooting the pilot in 2 weeks. I need you to get the talent for the show, the skaters. I need you to get the doubles for the actors. I need you to get with the wardrobe people. I need you to get the filmers. I need you to make this thing look as official as it could be. It's for Disney XD. It's a show called Zeke and Luther. So I got to hire like Aaron Mesa. You know, took the prop people to the skate shop. Here's what you need to buy. Got in his recession time. So skaters are losing sponsors and shit. So I'm like, yo, come do a couple kickflips, man. You're going to make $1,500 for the day. Ollie out of some curb cuts.
Yeah.
You got to wear a wacky Disney XD wardrobe, but whatever. Nobody's going to know it's you.
Yeah.
I remember getting the check and was like, holy shit, this is like,
damn.
I never seen no
TV money
like this. Yeah. But that was that. So it was like 2 months later, Ice Cream comes to an end, and I'm like, what am I going to do? I did a Geographic, you know, everybody knows Ice Cream's falling apart.
Oh, you shot the show in Philly?
We shot it here.
Oh.
But I ended up going back to Philly, you know, and you know, ego's hitting the fan once word gets out that Ice Cream's done, you know, because that's, you know, in my mind, everyone's waiting for this thing to fall off so they can point the finger at me.
Yeah.
Nobody cared, probably, you know.
Yeah.
They were probably psyched that I had the opportunity. They weren't thinking about it the way I was thinking about it. Do the Geographic. I'm like interning at my buddy's wife's PR company in Miami. I'm working at a sneaker shop down there. And then Fred calls me back. He's like, hey, the show got picked up. I'm going to connect you with the guy, Matt, that's running the show. He needs you back in LA in August. And I'm like, what does this thing entail? And he's like, we got at least 2 seasons. So I'm like, if I got 2 years of work, that's even remotely close to the bread that he paid me for the pilot.
Yeah.
I am chilling.
Yeah.
And I packed my shit from Miami.
What was the show called again?
Zeke and Luther.
Zeke and Luther?
Zeke and Luther,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was like a crash course in television. You know, it was like But I just got in there and was like, all right, I know what they need from me.
You're like a consultant.
Yeah. They gave me an office, and it was like every department was like, Jimmy, what do we do? So no I was low key the man. Like, yo, I had like
so dope.
Danny, it was like Jimmy could do no wrong in this building.
So you're at Disney Studios, you gotta follow you.
They gutted the Daily Breeze in Torrance, and so they turned it in. The Daily Breeze was all newspaper, and they turned it into a television studio. Whoa. So I had an office in there. The line producer, she loved me because, you know, she probably had 50 to 100 grand for stunts per episode. And I'm doing this shit for like 5 grand for her. You know, the stunt guys hate me because I know how to finesse. I'm like, you don't need these guys rolling and doing fucking cartwheels and forward rolls and shit. Like the skaters, we got this all figured out.
Oh, damn. So
I was like the man on it. And these checks are showing up. If I would have knew the game a little bit better, I would have really caked, because the guy didn't tell me till the second episode, the stunt coordinator was like, man, you should have casted yourself the day you shot the opening credits. You should have been in it, because you would have got residuals for every single. Damn. Dude, these kids were, I'm seeing my skate doubles in Hawaii. One's like, yo, Jimmy, I just bought a car.
Damn.
You know, like, and again, it's going back, this is recession time. Yeah. Like, guys are flat broke. So I'm like, yo, come one, come all. Like, you need money, come here. I got it.
Any skateboarders in it?
Bro, I had at least, I'd say at least 30 to 40 skaters I was able to rifle through this whole thing. Dude, I'm calling Lance Mountain. I'm calling everybody. Yo, like, they need ramps built, call Lance Mountain. Don't have that fucking guy that's never built a ramp in construction.
Straight up.
Like, call this guy, bring him on as a consultant.
And Lance is like, I can do it, but it's X, and fucking, it was a big
you know,
day
and guys were like, you know, they'd always be like, and I'm like, dude, do you know what this economy is like right now? You know, and then they'd get the check, you know. It's funny, but even those days, I would go pick the skaters up 4 a.m. in the morning, because our call time be 6 a.m. in Torrance.
Damn.
And they'd just be like, yo, just crawling into my car. And I'd be like, dude, you're about to make so much bread. You know, like, you have such little work to do.
Yeah.
But
they would not want to come. It's like
they just be banged up from they like, yeah, I just left LA, like the club, you know, like, you know, it was like those years, you know, it's like, fuck,
with
man.
With Muska,
like,
and shit, huh?
You know, I'm like, yo, you're making me look bad now, you know, so, but we ran it for 3 years, and then the week that the producer told me it didn't get picked up for a fourth episode was the same week that my lady told me she was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
No way.
And so I'm like, you're at the height of your career. I just lost my job. That's like this really niche thing. You can't segue this into another job.
Yeah.
You know, like, this was like a one in a million type of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what am I going to do? You know? And then we found out our daughter was going to be born with a super, super gnarly stomach defect. So it was like, the world, I felt like the world just like toppling on me at once. Wow. You know, like,
they could tell that when she was in the womb.
Dude, they found out. This was after the first ultrasound.
Really?
You know, yeah. And the gynecologist calls me and she goes, you know, she's like, are you sitting down? And I'm like, yeah.
Oh, wow.
You know, I don't even know if legally, I think legally she was probably supposed to tell my lady, but the gyno was a close friend of the family. And she's like, do you know what gastroschisis is? And I'm like, I have no idea what that is. And she goes, basically, everything's forming for your daughter, except for there's a small hole in her stomach lining right next to her belly button.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And she goes, that means that her intestines are basically not going to be fully enclosed.
Oh, man.
So it's basically like she's floating in, you know, in the amniotic fluid, and her intestines are exposed to this amniotic fluid.
Oh, no.
You know, and I just remember feeling like, almost feeling like I was going to collapse.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying? Like, just like spinning. Like, what did this lady just tell me? You know?
And,
she told me, and the next day I had to go with my lady. She had a show in Vegas, And I'm like, how am I going to tell her this? You know, so.
Oh, you didn't even. Oh, whoa.
She didn't know. So we get to Vegas and I'm like, babe, we got to sit down and talk. We get to the hotel. I think she was playing at like the Palms or something.
Wait, what does your lady do?
She's a singer. She's a singer. Yeah. And at that time, she's got like three or four massive records. She sung a record called Like a G6.
You know that song, Like a G6?
Yeah.
She does she's
that.
Hook.
She has that song. She's got a massive record called Dancing in the Dark. She's got another big record called Naked with Enrique Iglesias. And she, at that point, she's with, she, her and her crew were killing it. She came up with a crew called the Cataracts from the Bay, and they're on fire. They're still on fire. One of them is in a group called Terror Jr. that kills it. The other one, his name is Cashmere. He's a huge DJ. But at that point in time, they're like kind of the hit makers, and every label is coming to them for Devin to do a hook for them. They're in the studio with Timbaland. They're in the studio with David Guetta. They're in the studio with Diplo.
Oh, wow.
You know,
wow.
Like they were cooking. So it was like, you know, how did God set this up that this is what we're about to deal with?
Yeah.
You know? And I remember explaining to Devin, and she's just like, you know, she thought maybe it was like Down syndrome or something. You know, and I'm like, you know, yeah. I'm like, no, it's not that. It's an intestinal thing. And fortunately, UCLA has like one of the best high-risk doctors in the world by the name of Dr. Tabish. He agreed to take on Emilia's case and diagnosis. And we basically spent 2 years living in UCLA Children's Medical Center and or popping into like whatever hospital around the country if like Devin had a show and we took Emilia. Because it was like, you know, it was very unpredictable.
She's totally fine now, though, right?
Oh, yeah, she's killing it. She just has like a
little
scar. She's got a scar from hip to hip, but like at one point she had an ostomy bag. And next time we take her into the hospital, she gets surgery, comes out with two ostomies. You know, there was always these really unpredictable things with it.
And, that's heavy.
Yeah.
You know,
that's heavy.
It was just funny. The first meeting I ever went to, I didn't know about sharing or anything. And I remember this lady, Meredith. I love Meredith to death. She's like my AA mom. This is at Pathfinders. It gets to my turn to share. And I just like, I started at 2011 when Emilia was born and just like told my whole life story. And they're just like, whoa, this is not like you get 3 minutes. And I think, I think I went for like 15,
nah.
You know? Yeah. Like they just let me go.
Hey, you needed
they
to.
They just let me
it's
go.
It's really cool
yo.
Where sometimes you're in a meeting and someone will, like, you pick up on that person needs that time, and the room just lets them go.
Oh, bro,
you know what I mean?
They just let me fucking go. And I will go to that meeting for as long as I'm living where I'm living at, and my Tuesday morning at 8:30 a.m. is available. I will always go to that room because, you know, it was strange. There was another newcomer. I couldn't find it. You know, the Pathfinders is on.
Yeah.
I couldn't see it from the front.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thankfully, there was another guy going to his very first meeting at the same time as me, and we found it together. Maybe if he wasn't lost too, I might have got back in my car and not gone to that meeting. But
yeah,
that lady hugged me, and she told me to come to Cafe Tropical the next day, and then she told me to come to Cafe Tropical again Thursday. So it was an ill introduction. That was like, I have
That's
a
wild.
Weird mental connection between that starting point in my daughter's life and, you know, like that. There's something in there that I kind of connect my relationship with booze to around that time period, and specifically that first meeting. Yeah,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
When you got word of this news, like when you get word of the news, what's happening? You know, you're losing this job, this career that you got. You know, and then you got like, bam, you're about to have a kid. All this is going on. What, are you drinking heavy at that time? Are you like for relief,
you know,
or how is it
you,
kind of?
You know, I during that time period, I would do the thing where like I wouldn't drink for 6 months. This was another ill thing for me was, I had just ran the LA Marathon.
Oh,
I remember partying up to that New Year's, and then after New Year's, I was like, I need a break from boozing. I need a break from weed. And I would do that thing where I would dry up for five, 6 months and go super hard. Mm-hmm. Dude, it was the 2011 LA Marathon. It rained. It was like torrential downpours the whole time.
Like everybody running in the rain?
Everybody. From the moment I got to Dodger Stadium, it started pouring. And it poured the entire... I ran through like 2 feet of water at like the VA hospital.
No way.
I ran as my first marathon under 4 minutes. It's the only marathon under 4 hours. It's the only marathon I ever ran. But I always tripped because I was like, how did that happen for us with Amelia? When we were trying to put the pieces together as to what... You know, I was like, bro, we were both in excellent condition, you know? But shortly after, you know, it was like... All right, I'm not super health guy again. Like, I can start having beers. And I even remember the night that my lady's water broke, like, cracking a tall can, sitting on the deck, having a cig. And then, like, 2 hours later, Devin wakes up and she's like, I think my water broke. I'm like, well, we got to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
You know? Just trying to figure out, because it was an experience that definitely, I think she had her final surgery in May of 2013, and it took me years to exhale from, man. You know, like, there was a certain feeling of, like, mental.
2013?
Yeah, she was.
Oh, wow.
So she was born December 2011, last surgery. God, yeah. I mean, and this is surgery after surgery after surgery.
Oh, my
gosh.
Like, is she 14?
She'll be 14 in December.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
Like, you know, it's... taking her in, and one surgery, she comes out and she has like some sort of like respiratory attack. So now they got on a breathing machine.
Oh,
you know, her belly didn't work, you know? So it was like every time you would get surgery and the muscles touched physically, it stops. So she's got to learn to basically, her stomach has to reactivate. But because of that, you can't ingest food. Yeah, there were, you know, Devin would be Googling raising a child with an ostomy bag. We're Googling if it doesn't work at all, is she connected to like a lipid machine for years to come? You know, there was a massive portion of her stomach that was infected from the amniotic fluid that had to get cut. Like, it was about as severe as it could possibly be.
My kid came out not breathing.
Oh, man.
Like, I'm in the fucking room at Cedars, and I'm sitting there. You know, watching your wife in labor is fucking wild.
It is.
And I'm sitting there, and Zoe's on the thing, and all of a sudden, like, you know, like a handful of motherfuckers come in from out of nowhere and start setting up this little table. And they're, like, talking, like, literally, like, hey, did you see the Dodger game? I swear.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And they bring when my kid finally comes out, like, she's not breathing. Like,
oh, shit.
They bring her, set her on the table, and this group of motherfuckers is, and I told the nurse, I'm like, yo, is my baby okay?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm like, and she goes, she's going to be fine. And I'm like, I watch her go to that table. I'm like, she's not moving. And they put her on the table, and this fucking group of fucking heroes or whatever, like, got to work. But she had to go into that NICU for a minute.
Man, yeah.
So fucking sad. Had like a little,
bro.
Your girl probably had it too.
Hell yeah.
Fucking needle in there. Like tiny little hand.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It's fucking heartbreaking.
Yeah, Amelia, she's got a scar on her chest from, you know, she had a PICC line. She had gastro tubes going in. Like, you name it, she had it.
Yeah.
You know, so like, thank God.
That's so dope that she's completely normal.
Man,
that's so fucking sick.
All that.
Wow, I see pictures of you and your kid. I'm like, that kid?
When I think back on it, man, I'm like, holy shit, man. Like, God, we were blessed back then far beyond I could have ever imagined. You know,
It's weird because it sounds like, you know, you're like, you're wondering why your luck's so bad, but then we never see the part that, like, the best motherfuckers at UCLA. You know what I mean? Like, that, like, really, that's the blessing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's insane, right?
To think, dude, like, if you were in fucking Ohio,
you know what I mean? This guy was, like, you know, women would come in and have to wait 2-3 hours, which is pretty gnarly for a checkup, but that's what it was with this guy, you know? And he laid out the plan, the delivery plan. I called him on the phone when our water broke. You know, he knew how to work with Devin. he knew how severe it was, and he knew what to not let us in on because of how much stress it was.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. You know, so, but it was, yeah, coming out of it was like, you know, it was a difficult thing, man, to wrap my head around, you know.
And, thank God.
Have you ever seen a ghost, Jimmy?
Have I ever seen a ghost?
You lived in a fucking mortuary. You had to see a ghost.
Yeah, you know, between growing up there, the time spent in the hospital, I'm going to tell you a story. And then when my mom bought her house outside of the hood, it was right across the street from a funeral home. This story will trip you out. Mm. This was the first Christmas we were after Amelia was born. So it's December. She's born 12/9/11. So Chris, that first Christmas, you know, we just would go. We'd stay in the
She's
NICU.
Like 2 weeks old.
Go home.
Yeah,
go stay in the NICU. The doctors would say, go home, get some rest, call and check up on. That was our routine. So that Christmas, this lady, we get there early in the morning, and I think she's like they have janitors, people cleaning, and then they had people that would hold the babies and stuff. And this older Mexican woman, she comes up and she gives us this little porcelain. This is fucking trippy. She gives us this little porcelain angel that had something inscribed in it. And so later on that day, you know, we were like, thank you so much. You know, and she was like, say really nice stuff about Amelia. And she's 6 pounds soaking wet, you know. And I remember that Amelia's primary nurse comes up and she's like, and I'm like, yeah, that, you know, who was the lady that, you know, that kind of tended to this area in the morning? Like, I you know, we want to thank her again. She gave us this little ornament. Nobody knew who she was. Not a doctor, not Whoa. A nurse. Like, multiple nurses were like, we have no idea who you're talking about.
Whoa.
We still have this little.
No
we,
way.
Yeah. So, wow. yeah. So, that's
an angel. That's an angel. Yeah. Wow. Like
that. It sounds fake.
That's, no. You know, like,
yeah. That's wow. We ask wow. every guest that they've ever seen a ghost, and there's a second question we'll ask in a bit. You know? But that's the most wholesome ghost story we've ever heard
that's
all these years
ghost
later.
Story you want to hear.
That's actually the best one.
The best one, yeah.
Like, hands down.
Yeah.
You know, it's still, it sounds fake, you know, saying like me and my girl will tell, like play that back to each other. And we're like,
wow,
that doesn't make any sense at all. No. You know, so.
So after Amelia gets better, you know, she's on the mend. You guys are then living here in LA and you're working in the field you're kind of in right now doing your thing.
I luck, my mentor, Greg Lucci.
Oh, no way. Okay.
Devin is recording at a studio in next to Sunset Plaza. And I've known Greg from Aesthetics, and I'm going to studio sessions with Devin a lot. And this was right when Buscemi leaves Gourmet and Lucci goes, bro, I need a marketing person. And I'm like, where do I start and what do I do? You know? And he's like, you already know what to do. Had no idea what to do. He just threw me to the wolves and allowed me to learn everything.
For what brand?
For Gourmet.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
For Gourmet,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I repped Gourmet for like a minute out of my showroom right around the... I had a showroom right around the corner from where... Wasn't John working out of the offices of Oliver Peoples?
Yes, yeah, that's where it was. Yeah, yeah, that same office space. So I worked there for 2 years... We buy a crib. The same week we buy a crib, I get a stop work notice at the company shutting down.
Yeah. Gourmet.
Every time you get one will, and you get an L.
Danny. Yeah, yeah. And fortunately, Luch goes, Jimmy, I got just enough money to hold me, you, and this other guy over until we find another licensee. So Luch looked me out. Luch goes, I'm going to walk you into James Bond's office. James said he'll give you a job, and I like, dude, I can't whatever this next thing is for me, I can't earn it this way. You know what I'm saying? I gotta see what I could do.
Wow.
And I end up taking a job with a small street. Not small. They were actually crushing it. A company called Pink Dolphin.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember.
Their office was right next to my home, so I got to take Amelia to preschool. Go to the office. I could do that, like, little Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
And then at some point in the game with that company, it started to get funny style with the owners. And, you know, that's when I noticed, like, my first really bad period with booze kick in, though, because it was kind of this mind game that I felt like they were playing with me. You know, and I felt in my mind I was like handling their business really well and checking all the boxes. So I was like, you know, I just felt like, man, none of these kids here have, you know, it's a very young based company, young graphic designers. You know, I'm like, why am I the one that the most, you know, like the most games are being played with? This is what I'm telling myself. I've got way more to lose than, you know, and there probably were things, you know, Vegas trade show nights things where I probably wasn't.
That was definitely around the Creative Rec days, and there was like a lot of shit going on.
Did you guys know each other back then?
No, huh?
I think I knew who you were, though.
Okay.
For sure. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, if you were working at Gourmet and then picked off, we definitely crossed paths for sure.
But that was the first patch where it was like, I was super miserable. I was very unhappy with the situation, but I didn't have anything else lined up.
Yeah.
And the head games, like, or at least the head games that I was telling myself were being played were like,
yeah,
you know, and I couldn't afford to just, you know, you got a mortgage now, you got a baby.
Yeah.
You know, and those were the nights where it was like, I put Amelia to sleep, Devin would go to bed, and that's when I really started hitting it, man. It's probably 20...
Drinking alone.
16, yeah. You know, like, just on the porch, like, crushing a pack of Parliaments and, like, whatever, an 18-pack, and,
damn,
you know, like how am I going to get myself out of this predicament that I find myself in, thinking that I've blown all my credibility in this space working for this brand on one hand, which is probably a fucked up way to be thinking. And then on the other hand, knowing that I knew I did a good job for what was being asked of me within the role. So it was like this really dark space that I found myself in.
Right, right. And that was how you were coping with it. That was the mechanism, drinking. Yeah. Did that continue through like your other like gigs as you kind of moved through, you know, the next couple of years?
A 1,000%. You know, 1,000%. And this is like another...
But I feel where it's coming from. It's like you have this like core of your foundation is in skateboarding and it's earned.
Yeah.
And like now you're in this world where like Pink Dolphin was a fucking like streetwear brand kind of built on ego and the roots of like a whole thing, right?
You know, so they have a real thing.
I mad respect what they did in the game. I'm not talking shit, but I'm saying like, but where you were at, you were kind of being fucked with. At that time, there were a lot of egos
in the business. And people were always tripping too. Like, I remember like the first post that I did, like kind of alluding and people being like, bro, Jimmy, are you all right? Like, you know, like, we can find you, you know, and I'm like, no, like, this was a path that I felt I needed to go down, you know, like, this was, until I found myself questioning everything and handling that questioning with...
It's funny, we all, like, out-cool ourselves.
Yeah.
1,000%.
You know, I was thinking when you said that, like...
It's a great way to say what I was trying to say.
If you think about, like, the music we listen to, right, any of us here, right, like... None of us listen to Justin Bieber or Harry Styles, probably, but guess who sells fucking 30 million records?
Yeah.
Those, you know what I mean?
Speak for yourself, Keith.
You know what I mean? I fuck with Harry Styles.
I remember, you know, like, when Dill started FA, no, like, Val Surf couldn't even get it.
Yeah.
Like, if you sold streetwear, you couldn't carry it.
Yeah, he only sells to, like, really premium retailers that carry, like, collections and shit. Yeah.
It was only us and Supreme for the first fucking 8 years or something.
Wow.
Oh, that's a trip.
You know, in LA, I'm saying. Like, but, like, it's funny, like, you know, like, the way that we're raised, especially from the skateboarding world, you know, like, it ain't good enough Jimmy's going to make paper at this place.
Yeah.
He should go work at fucking Vision Streetwear and make...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Fuck, I tried to launch Vision Streetwear.
I remember that. I know, that's why I was clowning.
That was one of my big comebacks.
One of those dark nights, it's probably like 10 o'clock, I got a call from the guy that was the creative director at Gourmet. prior to. His name's Mark Gaynor. Mark had helped design the shoes for Native, Canadian guy.
The rubber shoes?
The rubber shoes. Mark Mark is one of the most talented individuals I've ever met. And I'm lost. I have no idea what I'm doing with my career. My credibility's out the window. I now have established that I'm like, I'm numbing myself every night.
I'm so sorry. I just looked at you and like pictured you in like a pink fucking hoodie with like a fucking dolphin.
No, they would. I would sprinkle a piece on, and I think that even made people within the building upset that I didn't.
You were just dripped out in it.
Yeah. But Mark calls me and he goes, "I'm starting this handmade shoe company in Venice. We're going to be making $1,000 handmade shoes. I'm partnered I have great financial backing. They've got a great reputation, and I want you to come on board to do the marketing." And I'm like, "Holy shit! There is
that was Gourmet.
This was a new company called No One, just No One, because the idea initially was that it was like it was faceless. The identity of the company was like No One." Is bigger than these shoes. No one made like it was a very it was such an amazing idea, and I drive over to across the street from Superbo on Lincoln, and which I laugh because I'm like, man, I used to cop my weed here back in the day, and it's in this beautiful studio. He's got three or four guys in there making handmade shoes. I see the graphics, and Mark is good at like making books and magazines, so he has all these pamphlets he's already designed and created for it. And I'm like, Mark, I don't know anything about, like, this is $1,000 shoes. I don't know any high-end PR people. I don't know, like, ballers like that. You know, like, I'm a skate rat, and I'm coming from Pink Dolphin. And he goes, Jimmy, you know how many designers at Nike worked at Skechers for a little bit? You'll be fine. That's what he said to me. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to put my 2 weeks in. And, man, I had, like, the most amazing people come to my support to help get that company going.
That's cool, man.
Like, you know, people that were beyond my wildest dreams of ever meeting, and let alone them kind of, like, rallying for me. And
that's awesome.
Somehow we end up making the shoes for the Sixers' number one draft pick. And the way that the stars
were they sneakers?
They were our big shoe looked like a samba. It was like a German army trainer.
Oh, okay.
And I get connected with this kid who's at the time he's like the second or third pick, and then the Sixers trade for the one pick and they want him. So I'm like, what are the odds that I'm getting the chance to make this kid for
Silly.
The shoes, and now the Sixers are about to take him.
And he's from that's wild.
Yeah.
So you know, I'm like, and this is the ill part of it. It's like one of the most glorious days of my life. My career is saved. And I end up doing the same thing that night that I was doing when I was miserable for Pink Dolphin.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, this is like, I was celebrating when I was sad, and now I'm celebrating when I'm happy. And I'm still kicking my ass.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that the draft was, that was 20... That was June of 2017, and the Eagles going to run that year. I go to watch them play at the Coliseum, and I get back, and my lady goes, "You might need to take a break. You know, like, you're kind of getting to it." December 2018. She's like, "You're kind of getting to it. Like, it's, you know, like, why don't you chill for a little bit?" And I ended up putting down booze for a good 3.5 years.
Oh, wow.
Until COVID. And was like, all right. I was smoking weed, and then eventually weed. I was like, I can't do it. You know, but I saw within that time period, I saw like great things happening for me, especially career-wise, when I wasn't boozing.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, you in my mind knew like, yo, this is what happens when you're not kicking your ass and you're getting to it.
Yeah.
But I still didn't have the knowledge to put
the self-awareness and all that. And then there's all that other stuff, too. If you're an alcoholic and you stop taking your medicine, then there's all that other shit that comes. Like, at first, you pink cloud, whatever, but then the self-doubt and the, you know, the what's it called? Like, the, you know, the big ego followed by the worthlessness. You know, I forget it said in a very eloquent way in meetings. But, you know, all that. The wheels are turning all the time. You don't have a way to shut it off. You know, now you're not really doing meetings and book stuff, so you don't have the tools to kind of quiet your mind that way.
I still know nothing about AA during that time frame.
Yeah, you're just dry.
Just dry.
Oh.
And, you know, so I'm, but I have a little bit of evidence to be like, if you don't, if you're not boozing, you're working way harder and, you know, there's obviously there's other things in life that I'm falling short of, you know, because I'm still there's still boxes that need to be checked and addressed. But then, that was I remember saying if I get back, you know, it's COVID. So I'm like, I haven't seen my mom in a year. I remember saying if I get back to Philly and see her and everything's fine, we don't know what's going on. Yeah. I'm going to have a drink, you know, and, you know, it wasn't the spiral wasn't instantaneously, but I there were things I recognized like that, like, yo, this is already like an issue. Like, I started to have really bad, like, digestive issues and stuff. And I'm trying everything. Like, I'm going to try to be vegan. I remember my buddy sent me to this, like, this lady in fucking Altadena, and she's putting little like gems on me. She's like balancing. And she's like, oh, yeah, you're allergic to flour, you know? And my lady's like, bro, you know, like.
Anything but quitting drinking.
Anything but
quitting
drinking.
That's why Reno stopped. Yeah, that's why Reno's been fucking, she glued
this celiac. No,
she's the one
that diagnosed
it.
At Whole Foods by the masseuse.
He gave me so much shit for so long.
He still does.
I didn't find out I was celiac till I was like 6 years sober.
But it was a chiropractor named Armin Arkilian who told him.
I've got a sister who who I found out about 5-6 years ago. And she's told me she has celiac, you know? So it's like, you know, dude, if you're just crushing like Coronas and Stellas, like this.
It's all,
you know,
wheat and barley.
Like,
yeah.
Were you all fat and shit, Jimmy?
What's that?
Were you getting all fat?
So, this is funny. We were listening to Matt's episode this morning, and my lady goes, "What are you going to tell him about Juicy Jim?" So Juicy Jim was like the year and a half leading up to me finding the rooms of AA.
Juicy Jim.
She coined me that.
She got bars, huh?
So I probably got up to like 190, 200.
Ooh.
You know, like.
What are you right now?
170.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, like.
30 pounds.
But it's noticeable. You know, even with an XL, it's noticeable. Yeah. You know, like.
Yeah. Is that an XL?
No, this is a medium. You know, like that's where. I could look in the mirror and see in my skin, everything. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I was like, there's no way my lady still finds me attractive right now. Like, I can't believe for the last couple of years that she was willing to, like, lay in bed next to me. Because I was so not.
Oh,
I was
man.
A fraction of the person. Yeah. That I thought I was, you know.
Dude, Juicy Jim.
So Juicy Jim was cutting it up every night,
Juicy
doing the
Jim.
Damn thing.
Juicy Jim, yeah, that's the name of the episode.
Well,
you know
that's the name of the episode.
Yes,
that's it.
Juicy Jim. So Juicy Jim, in I want to say my last like run, 2013. I started a conversation with the Philadelphia Eagles. And for the opportunity to work with them on a collaborative project. And I basically told my lady, like, everything in our life is on hold until this project is done.
Because
this is their first time working with a clothing brand or an individual. I'm working with the owner's son, Julie and Lori.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, it was me and Julie. And I, you know, like, they're marketing people. They're like, yo, basically Julian said, whatever you want to do, We have to trust you because this is Julian's project. And so everything in my life went on hold to like the worst extent, you know, like falling short in every capacity of a fucking grown ass man with a 12-year-old daughter,
right,
that needs your emotional support, a wife that needs like someone competent enough to like clean baseboards. Like, I was in such tunnel vision to get this thing done.
The demands are crazy when you're working with a big entity like that.
Man, they're kicking us from the team to the NFL to their lawyers, you know, and I'm like, this thing's got to get done. Like, it, like, no ifs, ends, or buts.
What
like,
company was that with?
That was with Standard Issue
and
JSP.
Okay.
So
JSP is a sub-brand?
Yes, yeah, that was kind of like the collaborative ladder that we used for some years to get these projects going.
Right.
You know, but the day, literally the day that I checked my final box for that project was we shot a lookbook at an Eagles tailgate. You know, like I had put together a lookbook with Randall Cunningham and his son.
Yeah.
Like I did all these things. I was like, I kind of blacked out on getting this thing done. But the day that I checked that final box for that lookbook was like when I just kind of took my hands off the wheel. You know, and this was October 10th of 2013. I was like, all right.
2013?
I'm sorry. 2023. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I fucked my dates up or years up. And up until the release at the event, at the stadium, partied through it.
Damn.
New Year's. I'm sorry. Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's.
You just went in.
And just went in. Go to Paris for a skateboarding contest. Don't see daylight. And I got back, and I was like, "Yeah, something's off, babe. I got to get into the doctors. You know, like I maybe it's time to get my annual physical." And she's like, "Oh, you're a couple months early, you know." And I had some ill moments. I had buried a close friend of mine a year prior too, named Robbie McKinley, an old skateboarding friend. You know, I had someone kind of plant the seed of AA in my head 2 or 3 years prior to Austin.
Yeah.
Working out one morning.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So I kind of had now I have things kind of really opening up those doors in my mind towards it. I get back, get my blood work done, don't hear from my doctor for about a month. So assuming everything's fine. I'm still Juicy Jim, though. You know, like, still pushing 200, like, looking bad. And
still drinking.
Still drinking. And then finally the doctor calls me and he's like, "Jimmy, you got a moment?" And I was like, fuck. You know, like, I saw roller coaster of life kind of, kind of going towards the backside of the ride now.
Oh, wow.
You know, and even my doctor was a bit confused, like kind of trying to find excuses for me. Like, you know, did you take medicine that morning or did you work out? And I was like, no, why? And he's like, because your liver enzymes are up. You know, and that's when I said, like, all right, game is over. You know, like, throw in the towel. You know, you did this for 24 years now, like the doc, you can't refute what your doctor's telling you, you know. And I think only me knew how bad it was, you know. Like, I spent years hiding it behind everything, hiding it behind a beautiful family, hiding it behind success I was finding, but knowing inside I was like paper thin, you know. And I remember that day going on a desktop and looking for meetings, and I found that one at
really
Pathfinders. Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. That's a trip, man.
And then the next day
I waited about a week because I remember telling my lady is like,
maybe I overreacted.
Yeah. You know, my lady was kind of like, you know, you've quit before, you know, like, and I said, nah, babe, like I'm much worse inside than anybody else knows. And you're the first person I'm telling.
It was a trip because like when we went to that, your second meeting or whatever, mm-hmm. together, Yosemite, you know, I'm used to people coming to me, Danny, or our circle, like strung out on dope, meth, fucking the walls are caving in, like
benzos,
you know what I mean? I got court cases. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm back living at my mom's house and stuff, and it's like on the outside, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, because even as we were having a conversation, really, it became apparent to me only after talking to you at length that you were like, it was everything that was going on inside of you.
Man.
That was the bottom.
Danny.
You know, everyone's bottom's different.
I had no idea any of this existed. Yeah. I knew nothing about AA. I just knew that this one kid, Austin, told me it's where people go. I'd be working out with him, you know, and I'd be in there hating him because he'd be kicking ass. And I'd be banged up from the night before from like a Sixers game or something. We'd be working out. And I'm making excuses. Oh, when he's 43, he'll understand this. You know? I remember being 32 once. You know, like those were all the. You know, but those even back then, I think Austin was, because he would invite me to meetings. I'm like, why is this fucking guy keep inviting? I don't need fucking AA. Why does he keep? What am I gonna look like there? You know, like I'm not an AA person.
Jimmy's all thinking he's gonna be the youngest dude there.
but I'm like, I don't have an issue. Yeah. Like, what? I don't have a problem. There's nothing's wrong with me. And until I couldn't lie anymore. You know, I couldn't keep telling myself, you know, a story that wasn't true. It was like the first time, you know, but that first meeting was like the weight lifting off, you know, and
was the first one when you did the 15 minute share?
Yes.
Wow. Of course, dude.
That's Keith, so sick.
Keith, I cried and those tears felt like they weighed 100 pounds each. And it was like I Juicy Jim wasn't juicy anymore. It was like that was the first day I started to shed all of this shit.
It's huge, and, it's huge.
You know, it
That's the magic of this program at work right there.
Bro, I've driven past this place a million times.
Yeah.
I told you the story about working with Danny at El Cochinito. Like, I never knew that this was a holy ground for sobriety. I never knew how much support there is out there in the world for this so long as you ask for help.
You just gotta ask,
What about this fucking dummy? It was all loaded and saw people standing outside and he thought it was an art show. He was trying to come in to get, to get free beer.
Yeah.
He actually asked him if they had free beer.
He went in there looking for drinks. Yeah. You don't know that?
Friday, Saturday meeting,
When I see people like you guys and 95% of the people that I meet in the program, I can't picture a Reno that was living these stories that he's told me. I can't
slamming heroin to smoking speed.
Danny can't walk 2 feet without shaking. I'm like, how does Danny even operate this business? Because
the mayor,
he's got all of these people that love him in here. And I hear what you do, Keith, and then you helping me.
Yeah, you know, imagine like, him on the prison yard. Yeah. You know, it's like hard to imagine, man.
It's difficult for me to even understand there was once a world that is a life that you guys don't live anymore because of how upstanding
that,
you are.
Even Reno?
even Reno, man. Yeah. No.
I talked to Gilbert about this sometimes. You know, today there was like a newspaper article with him and say, Gilbert Trejo. Yep. I don't know if you met him, you know, and we'll talk and we're like, dude, there's this motel that we used to stay on York, the Highland Park Motel, you know, and it was like one of the darkest places. We would stay there, we'd get a room there, and then we couldn't afford it. And then we'd be like, hey, but we can't leave because we don't have anywhere to go. And we would like come up with some of the money, and they'd be like, oh, we have a room that's under construction, and you guys could stay there for half price. I would be like, dude, hallelujah.
You swear to God.
You know? Yeah. And I talked to him, and I'm like, he's like, you know, there's still like a parallel universe where we're still stuck in that fucking motel trying to figure this out.
That's
fucking
wild, man.
And it's so true.
That's
just like, why, you know, and it's like, by the grace, you know, like.
Danny
like,
went to deliver dope to Gilbert when Gilbert was going to rehab, and fucking Danny Trejo jumped off the balcony like machete.
Danny Trejo came out. He was taking out the trash.
He told me this. Yeah.
I had to make amends to Danny Trejo for that.
Fuck,
yeah.
Man.
Gilbert calls me. He goes, that was the first time in 10 years that my fucking, that my dad took the trash out. You know, he goes, of course it's the day you're here. Yeah. And he goes, just can you meet me around the corner? I go, no, why not?
You know, for the last 15 years, I've worked for the skateboarding contest that basically from when Amelia was born. about 4 to 6 times a year, they send me to like these beautiful places of the world to judge skateboarding at. It's like the fakest job ever. And it's like the ultimate recipe for dark fun. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, those would be the trips where I could be like, all right, as soon as I get to the airport, I can get a michelada. But as soon as I got into AA, I got thrown right back in those. Mm-hmm. And that was the ultimate test of my faith.
Yeah.
You know, I would be on the airplane. Alone. Bro, on the plane reading, like, fuck it, I'm reading these stories in the back of the book.
Yeah.
You know, I remember we were in Sydney, Australia, and I opened
hungry
up the meeting guide.
This shit.
Hungry, bro.
Yeah.
Bro, I took a $100 cab ride to the other side of Sydney because the meeting app told me there was a meeting there. I get there, and it's just this one little old man from the UK. And me and him sat there and just talked sobriety for a couple hours.
I've had great meetings like that too, man.
Wow. Like, yeah, like, dude, I've gone to meetings everywhere I travel. I'll go to a meeting. I'll be in Stockton or Central Valley with my lady. I'll find a meeting there.
I bet the meetings are live out there.
Incredible, yo.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I found a meeting, an English-speaking meeting in Sao Paulo. Again, one English-speaking person there.
Wow.
You know, like, so I got through right back into, like, the test of, like, how strong my, you know, and then just other things, man, like having to coach my daughter's soccer team and being responsible for guiding this group of like incredible 13-year-old young ladies, like little things where understanding the service component in the rooms is now extending to like my real life. And, you know, obviously my lady still like has to put a foot up my ass as today, like I was saying, like, you know, but I can clean the baseboards more efficiently now. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
I don't know. I got to imagine it's like the closest thing, you know, to being saved to some degree.
Straight up. I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, all of us were saved from the fire, man.
Yeah. You ever smoke PCP?
Never.
That's the last question.
I got two skateboarding-esque stories that I got to share, you know? One, I had two, maybe, all right, two quick ones, you know? So I grew up, you know, but growing up in L.A., like, we skate, like, you know, we would fucking, like, yeah, we were hanging it, like, we were, like, kicking it at fucking Brooklyn Projects, you know, we were kicking it at Chopped. We had Fairfax to go skate at. We had Courthouse. We had, like, spots where you would go, and it was, like, these dudes that we had looked up to were there every single day. My elementary school, Laurel, there was a little...
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Laurel, and we would just be there fucking around because we didn't want to skate anywhere else to get fucking ripped. You know, like, Muska pulls up, and he's like, yo, whoever hits the first fucking kickflip on this four-stair gets a complete, you know? And we're all just throwing ourselves. Like, you know, 9 years old, just throwing ourselves fucking until one of us fucking caught it, you know? Like... So growing up, that was like, it was dope, you know? I never got good, but my sister was the one that kind of introduced me to skateboarding, where she saw me hanging out with these like Russian mob kids in the area, in the neighborhood that I lived in. And we would like, they would basically, we ended up kind of being like their scapegoats, where they would give us spray paint. They'd be like, hey, go tag on these walls, you know? And we would go right on shit. Meanwhile, they'd be inside the house, like tying somebody up, robbing them, committing some kind of crime. Yeah.
So no way.
Like the distraction, yeah, because people are like, look at what are these kids doing in the broad daylight, you know? And they'd be like, if you don't do this shit, we're going to fuck you up and we're going to come and like steal your parents' cars and threaten us, you know? And we knew they were serious, you know? And she saw me hanging out with them and like, I shit you not, they got us little tracksuits, you know? We had like little tracksuits.
Bullshit.
So yeah. And my sister saw this and she was like, nah, this ain't happening. And she was working at this, I forget the name of it. There was a vegan restaurant in Westwood Village. And with her, one of her first paychecks, she got me a fucking complete, I don't remember what it was. It was like some, you know, and she gave me a bag of weed. And she was like, this is your life now, you know? And I swear to God, we took a hit of a joint and like that fucking tracksuit disappeared, you know?
How
and I never,
old do you think?
I don't know, you know?
They bought you tracksuits.
Yeah. We were young. We were like 10, 11, you know?
God.
Yeah.
I remember buying like a nickel bag of weed around the same age.
Oh, yeah.
And like the guy that we bought it off of, he rolled us the joint. And then like the badder kid that I hung out with, he smoked the whole thing. Uh-huh. I didn't even want no parts of it. You know what I'm saying? That's fucked up how bad, like, the shit we would indulge shit, in yeah. at that age back in the day, yo.
There was a, but like, yeah, like we rolled it and I remember like the seeds popping everywhere. Yeah, you know, we didn't know, but she didn't tell us to take the stems or seeds. It's like a fucking flute because all the stems poke out through it, you know? But, and like growing up, you know, I was kind of like around it, you know, like, so there was these kids on you, Gabe and Jeremiah, and they were like good. They were younger than us, but they would like, they could fucking skate, you know? And these kids, like, were like, promising. Like, we were like,
what part of L.A. was this?
This is, like, by, like, West Hollywood area. Because okay, I lived around, you know? So, like, they would skate Fairfax. And they were kind of, like, they got in with, like full, like, the older, like, the some of the pros kind of took them under their wing, you know? And I remember them, I was like, oh, where'd you guys go? They're like, oh, we were out with Costin and Barra the day before. Yeah. They took us out skating. And I was like, what? Like, dude, like, Costin's my favorite skater, you know, all time. And they were like, oh, that fool lives like right there. And I was like, where does he live? You know, I just want to go pull up. So they went and they showed us where he lived. And we were like, dude, like, we're just going to like camp outside until they get there, you know? And we pull up one day and we were like, all right, we're just going to get like autographs or whatever. And we go there and we're like looking and they're not there, you know, they're fucking gone. Uh-huh. So we're like, fuck, man. Like, you know, and then somebody, I don't know if it was probably me, cause I'm the kid that always had the bad ideas, you know? And I was like, yo, like, I was like, If we take their shoes, then we'll skate better. And they had like some old fucking, some raggedy beat up
shoes. Sneaks.
So we told them, and we like going, you know, and we're like kids, you know, and they're adults. So we put on their shoes. We're like clowns, you know, hey, fucking spoiler alert. Yeah. We don't skate no fucking better, you know?
So and they're like three sizes big for you. Exactly.
So then I'm like, yo, what we got to do is we got to like, maybe we got to get their boards because then we'll skate better. And these kids are like it wasn't Gabe and fucking Jeremiah because they would have like roasted us for it. But it was like my other little homies. So we go there and I'm like, all right, we'll go and we'll do this. And like maybe if we get some complete. So we go there one day when they're having like a barbecue, you know, and they had all their fucking boards stacked on the front porch. And we like gaffled their fucking completes. Oh, they're skating, you know.
You got an amends to make.
Oh, dude. So fucking, you know, so we take off. Spoiler alert. Still fucking posers. We still
posers.
Yeah. So with like years, you know, I get, you know, like years later, I get fucking sober, you know, I get, and I'm doing Camille was, you know, our friend Jeff Cutter and Alexis have Boys of Summer, you know, and they were doing, they were shooting a lookbook at Astro, you know, like a restaurant that we all go fellowship at. And Camille was styling it. I was assisting Camille, you know. They're like, oh, whatever. I just wanted to fucking hang out and bullshit, you know. I didn't do fucking anything, you know. And I'm there, and fucking Costin's there. And I like, fucking, I'm like, fuck,
you
man.
You gotta tell him the story.
Yeah. And I was like, I gotta, you know. And I like, and it's something, you know, it's like, I, you know, these amends for me show up, you know. It's like, at times, like, it was like a story that I told, you know, but I was like, fuck, man. At that moment, I was like, I owe this fucking guy an amends. And I pulled aside Jeff Cutter, and I was like, yo, Jeff, what do you think, you know? And he was laughing and laughing. He's like, you got to talk to him. You know, you got to. So, like, Costin's whatever, like, you know, they shoot whatever thing that he's, and he, like, walks outside, and I kind of jam him up, and I'm like, dude, I got to tell you, you know, when I was a kid, you know, Gabe and Jeremiah, he goes, dude, I remember those kids. He's like, you're, and Jeremiah passed away trying to get sober, you know? He didn't make it, you know? Man. Gabe, I don't know what happened to, like, he skated for a while and then maybe fell off, but Jeremiah passed away. And I don't think he knew that. And he was like, oh, remember those kids? What happened? I was like, dude, Jeremiah was, he was waiting for a bed at fucking Midnight Mission and they found him outside in a tent, fucking passed away. When he was like 19, 20, young too. And I told him and he was like, fuck, man. I was like, yeah, you know? So I was like, I know Jeff and these guys, 'cause I've been sober for a little bit. And I was like, yo, I got to tell you that like when I was a kid, I used to show up and fucking, we used to, you know, we found out where you lived. They told me where you lived and we were going, we would take your fucking shoes and we would take your boards and we did this, man. And I was like, hey, I was like, you know, like you didn't deserve that and it wasn't fucking cool. And I have this like life and death path that I'm on. Yeah. I got to set these matters straight. So I got to let you know that I did that and it was not okay. And like, what could I do to make it right, man? Yeah. You know? And he just started, he goes, dude, he goes, and I was like, he just starts laughing. He goes, you know, he goes, we used to be like, who the fuck is taking our shit, man? He's like, what the fuck that's is going so funny, on? Yeah. You know, yeah. And he was like, yo, just keep on keeping on. Just keep
that's
going.
Cool, man. I talked to Eric about it here. Yeah. That night of the liars, we were outside. I go, I heard Danny made an amends to you. He goes, dude, he goes, that was so classic. He goes, he was probably doing us a favor. We had so much shit.
But it's crazy that type of stuff will eat at you, man.
Yeah.
Like, I definitely... Again, like when I got into my fourth step and stuff, like, you know, I didn't realize like the amount of things that went back you know, 20, 30 years, man, that I had held on to, man.
Yeah.
That, you know, like a lot of sleepless nights over shit that, like, you know, somebody I did wrong or just, you know, just those things in your mind that have left those dark impressions, man. Like, those are the things that ate at me over the years.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, man. Yeah. You know, like,
I forgot about the amends part with Costin. I thought you just jacked his shit.
No, yeah. No, there's an amends.
That's funny.
No,
yeah.
He made an amends.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Eric was stoked on it. Dude, it was funny.
And like, I see him, you know, he fucking, dude, he'll like bartend it fucking at the bar. He comes in here a bunch, you know. We did a big party with him when what's it called? When fucking
Cat Power
and
Idols
played fucking next
I definitely story. Had some fun nights with Eric over the years, man. Right. Yeah,
I love Eric.
Yeah, he's That's awesome, cool, yeah. Man.
That's real cool. I've only ever seen him in videos and magazines.
No,
he's one of those larger than life guys. Yeah, you know?
He's a god, man. You know, it's like one of those guys you grew up watching that like could do anything.
Yeah.
You know, and he's still, you know, all those guys are still like heroes to me.
Yeah.
You know, Abe and Dill.
Who was your favorite skater growing up?
Man, probably Josh Kalis or, you know, but I was a big, you know, I was a big Dill fan. I was a big Abe fan. I grew my hair out. I wore Stussy. I like, bro, I you know, I was about as impressionable as could be coming up. And, maybe Abe, you know, like I've got, I'll send you some photos. You'll be like, yeah, you were on Abe's dick. You know, like the whole thing. Like I had the whole Abe uniform on, you know.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, you got to send us some old pics.
Yeah, you'll laugh, man. Hair long, like, but...
Tell us what you're up to now, Jimmy.
Right now, I'm just trying to figure out. Just standard issue just today. Yeah, standard issue. We just moved down to Carson. We still have the best blanks and essentials in the game.
Dude, I...
Like, this is not it, but...
The best t-shirt ever, I think.
I bought some, by far.
Yeah.
But I bought some fucking pants for Gronk. And I'm not gonna... So I got... Jimmy always helps me out. Like, he'll bring it from the shop. Because, you know, it's all last minute. But I'm like, Gronk's fucking got a 38 inseam. And you know, but when you look at the break, you know, no pants technically have one.
He's a 38 inseam.
Yeah, but those pants fit him great.
That's awesome. Yeah. You'll probably be seeing yourself in ads a lot coming up.
Cool, all right.
I didn't know. Like, I'll post the stuff on the page, and then the company that does all of our digital stuff, they'll pick which ones to promote. So the one with you sitting outside with the loafers are like, this one's going to do good. So,
all right, cool.
You know, so I definitely owe you a lot more product.
Yeah, the slacker pants are something.
Dude, the slackers are the best. They're one of my hands down.
I try to break it up too, not because, you know, just to be like logo with the shirt and the pant.
Uh-huh.
I try to like mix it up and stuff, but it's like, it's the shit I like the most, you know?
That's been a trip, man. Seeing the level of support, you know, I like when I started to come to meetings and work a program, I didn't want to come in and ask anybody for anything, you know, and just through God's will in the program, people like you guys extending a hand to help beyond here, seeing that, like, yo, this is how Jimmy feeds his family, you know, like this is what I'm sure if you're Jimmy, like, yo, we need something for the cafe, he would do the same for me. Or, you know, like you said, I'll drop the shit off of your front door, Keith. Or, you know, anything with on, you're like, yo, Jimmy, got a project coming out. Like,
100%.
You know, it's a pretty...
That's
pretty
kind of how we all get down, though.
Man, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's awesome, man, because as you can attest to, I'm sure, Reno's like, this space in clothing and shoes is not a two-way street, man. It's a very...
Transactional. Right.
What can you do for me type thing? And I don't know. It doesn't always feel good.
Yeah.
But you guys have helped make life and business feel a lot healthier and happier through AA.
Yeah,
so
man.
I appreciate you guys.
Cool.
Thank you for having
you,
me on.
Yeah, thank you.
Jimmy. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you.
Don't we say the serenity prayer?
Yes, sir.